You'd like to be turning to Isaiah chapter 21. We're going to resume our study in the book of Isaiah. You'll notice we're getting toward the end of our outline here. And I have characterized this section in chapters 21 and 22, Oracles of the Assyrian Advance. That's just kind of I didn't have much room left on the PowerPoint to put all of the oracles up there, so I kind of lumped these together. They do have some things that suggest that they do go together, so hopefully that'll be helpful. But basically what we've seen in this section where Isaiah is developing this theme that God is the king, the ultimate king over the universe and sovereign of the nations, that he's been keenly interested not just in telling that as a particular point, that God's in control and God is the one who truly reigns and it's his authority we need to care about. But of course, Isaiah is writing all of this in the context of the Assyrian crisis that they face. And the particular problem is that Judah wants to either completely throw in the towel with the Assyrians or try to make various alliances to try to fend off the Assyrians. And Isaiah says, just trust the Lord and everything will be all right. And so he's been cataloging this theme of Judah's trust in various peoples. And the idea basically is don't get your hopes up. We saw that in chapter 19 and 20. Don't look to Egypt. Egypt will disappoint anyone that puts their hope in Egypt. That's not anywhere to look. And the other great power that Judah was tempted to put their hope in were the Babylonians. And so we've looked off far to the west. Can we get any help from Egypt? No, that's not going to do any good. And chapters 21 and 22 reveal the futility of looking to Babylon as a source of hope. Babylon, of course, was at this time ruled by the Assyrians just as much as anyone else was. And yet the Babylonians had a long tradition of being a powerful nation of their own and dreams of throwing off the yoke of the Assyrian overlords and recapturing some of that domination. And eventually, of course, they will do just that. And the Assyrians will eventually fall, and the Babylonians will be the ones that will be primarily responsible for that. And the Babylonians will inherit this world power status. But that's not going to happen yet. And so about 710, Sargon has to come down and put down a rebellion in Babylon, which was a significant event. That will be repeated by Sennacherib in 702. And again, what we see is every time one of these Assyrian emperors dies, there's an attempt by their various kingdoms they've conquered to try to revolt. And so each one of them has to put this thing down. And so Sennacherib had to repeat the process in 702. And that, of course, is significant because Hezekiah, of course, is part of this rebellion process. He had been a vassal to the Assyrians as well. And with the death of Sargon, he thought it would be a good time to test the waters against the Assyrians. And since everybody all across the empire was doing it, maybe you got a good chance of getting through this thing. And of course, as history turns out, Sennacherib was able to put down the rebellion all over his empire, and he eventually makes his way back to Judah. And that's the particular crisis that Hezekiah will be confronted with, that his nation's overrun by the Assyrian army, and he's besieged in the city of Jerusalem, and he's only delivered because he puts his trust in the Lord. And Sennacherib has to withdraw, you know. Sennacherib is ultimately going to come back and in 689 completely destroy the city of Babylon, which was seen as a big no-no because regardless of what nation you were from, everybody in that part of the world thought Babylon was a great holy city. And so even a lot of Sennacherib's own people thought this was sacrilegious and he was going to get his because of what he had done. And in fact, he winds up being assassinated by two of his own sons And that was seen as kind of a divine vindication of his sacrilege for having destroyed the city of Babylon. Of course, the city was rebuilt and came back, but that's the way these things happen. Well, it's hard to pin down exactly what the time period may be here. Is Isaiah talking about the initial putting down of Babylon by Sargon in 710? Is it closer to the 702 date where Sennacherib is, waging his besieging of Babylon? Either one's going to be at roughly the same time period, so I don't know if it's really going to make a big difference. But it's in that context, then, we want to look at chapter 21. And the first thing you'll notice is verse 1 says, "The oracle concerning the wilderness of the sea." Well, that's a little different, because all these oracles we've had up to this point have been oracle against the Babylonians, oracle against Moab, an oracle against Philistia or Egypt. And now we come to this wilderness of the sea. And likewise, chapter 22, you'll notice, says an oracle concerning the valley of vision. And that suggests these oracles may be a little bit more figurative, I guess, in a sense. And there are still some oracles, like down in verse 11, an oracle against Edom, and in verse 13, an oracle about Arabia, or your version may say down in verse 11, an oracle concerning Duma. We'll talk about that when we get there. But so there are some references to some places that we are familiar with here. But the context of this, again, basically is Judah, don't think you're going to be able to rely on the Babylonians. Well, why not? Well, the gist of chapter 21 here is that Babylon's going to fall. And the perspective isn't kind of up close in the city where Isaiah says, I can see the city of Babylon surrounded by armies and the city's on fire and all that. The depiction is, as you look across the desert here, you can see these refugees that come streaming through the desert trying to get away from Babylon, trying to get away from the Assyrians as they are advancing. And the effect of that is not only do you get the idea that Babylon has fallen, but the threat is coming closer and closer to you. And so as we follow these geographical references, basically they're getting closer and closer to Jerusalem till finally we wind up in chapter 22 in the city of Jerusalem, and you get the sense that the Assyrians are going to be right on the doorstep, which is what they're going to do. So that's the idea here. So are there any leftover loose end questions? Anything we need to get caught up on?
I was just going to ask, when you talk about the vassal nations rebelling against the Assyrians, that's primarily not paying tribute and kind of making them come reimpose it?
Right, yeah. The big issue was you had to pay these large sums of tribute or taxation. There were also obligations of providing armies, troops to, because obviously there wouldn't be enough Assyrians to dominate the whole world, but you fill out your army with auxiliary troops drawn from other nations. But again, the economic burden, it's all about money, you know, and you don't want to be sending all your hard work and harvest and all that to the Assyrians. And so, yeah, the people just quit paying their tribute. And, of course, the emperor can't put up with that. And he's got to make an object out of these people. So he goes around putting down the rebellion. Now, what Judah was fortunate about was, of course, that the Assyrians were going to be more concerned about their immediate neighbors, such as Babylon, because they were immediately to the south and they were the most powerful rebellious state to have to deal with. And so you go around putting out all the fires closest to your house, and then you got to make your way off to the west. You don't let anyone escape. You can't let anyone get by with this. And the only thing that could stop you is your army's incapable of imposing your will on these people. But for the Assyrians, that wasn't going to be a problem. So Hezekiah has several years where he's able to make preparations. So 705 is when the Assyrian emperor has died, and you've got this new guy, Sennacherib, and Sennacherib's not going to be able to come to Judah till 701. So Hezekiah's got 4 years to prepare himself for the inevitable attempt by the Assyrians to come back and bring them into line. So here's this oracle. As wind storms in the Negev sweep on, it comes from the wilderness, from a terrifying land. A harsh vision has been shown to me. The treacherous one still deals treacherously, and the destroyer still destroys. Go up, Elam, lay siege, Media. I have made an end of all the groaning she has caused. For this reason, my loins are full of anguish. Pains have seized me like the pains of a woman in labor. I'm so bewildered I cannot hear, so terrified I cannot see. My mind reels, horror overwhelms me. The twilight I longed for has been turned for me into trembling. What in the world's going on here? Well, in verses 3 and 4, you see the prophet's perspective. This is a vision that is so bad, it just tears him apart. He can't hear, he can't see, he's completely undone by how terrible this vision is. That's what he's trying to convey here. And the vision is against Babylon, as it turns out. Now, you can figure that out eventually, explicitly in verse 9, where a lookout that's been posted, here come a troop of riders, horsemen in pairs. And one answered and said, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon, and all the images of her gods are shattered on the ground." So this is the judgment that has come. Now, what's interesting about this is, remember back in chapter 13 and 14, we already had an oracle against the Babylonians. And what we suggested was that oracle was more about the spirit of Babylon, regardless of who the actual super world power might be at the time. And currently, it's the Assyrians that manifest this spirit of Babylon, the same Tower of Babylon mentality that we saw back in Genesis chapter 11. We're really going to be somebody. We're going to pool our resources together. We're going to have a big army. We're going to have all this money. We're going to have all this power. And that's what matters in this world. And that human arrogance that imagines that I can do what I want, and we can impose our will on people. And what they have forgotten is there is a God who is the king of the nations, and it is his will that will prevail, and the only power any nation has is what God allots to it and how he uses it for his own purposes. And so that arrogant human pride comes under God's condemnation as the spirit of Babylon back in chapters 13 and 14. And we noted what was kind of unusual about that would be at the time that Isaiah is doing his prophecy, Babylon is not a great world empire. Assyria is. And yet instead of starting with the Assyrians, he starts with the Babylonians. And then we noted at the very end of that section, he applies this to Assyria as if I've really been talking about Assyria this whole time. Well, what I would like you to think about here is here's a contrast between what we saw Isaiah saying in chapters 13 and 14 about the general spirit of Babylon and how that comes under God's judgment. But now in chapter 21, when Isaiah is actually talking about a literal judgment against the actual Babylonians, he's not gloating and saying, "Oh man, look at this. Oh, the Babylonians are going to get theirs. I'm just tickled pink," you know. The oracle in chapter 13 and 14 was more of a figurative, thematic kind of statement of God's judgment against all human pride. But when it gets down to an actual event where God is judging a people, Isaiah apparently sees it as completely disturbing. It is something to behold. And even though it's a pagan nation, it's a nation that would eventually become an enemy of God's people, it's not something Isaiah rejoices in. And so the vision of the fall of Babylon is still something that he finds horrible and painful to see of what God has shown to him. And I think you will see that's a pretty typical attitude that the prophets have. And I think you think about a kind of a contemporary modern application of this. I've heard plenty of sermons, you know, of preachers getting up in the pulpit and railing against some false teacher of one kind or another. And, you know, they'd suffer some downfall, you know, might be found out that they've been committing adultery or something. And it's just almost, you know, gleeful of the fall of these false teachers and so on. You know, that's not how God's people ought to be about any sin. We ought to be brokenhearted and weeping in tears. You know, there are occasions where we need to talk about those who teach false doctrine and that they come under God's judgment, but it's not that we're jumping up and down and smiling the whole time. And this is the spirit of the prophets, that it doesn't matter who it is, whether it's an Israelite, whether it's a Gentile, God's judgment is not something that is a gleeful thing. Sometimes it is something you can be grateful for because it brings relief to God's people. It relieves the suffering, the oppression that people have been bringing against God's people. But again, it's not just, you know, judgment's not something you rejoice in. You know, the Jews developed this notion that one of the great pleasures of heaven was going to be having a balcony seat to look at the Gentiles writhing in torment and hell. Well, I don't think that's a Christian attitude, that one of our great pleasures is going to be getting to see our enemies or whatever being tortured. So for whatever reason, Isaiah finds this particular vision extremely painful. And he says he longed for the twilight, but he didn't get any comfort from that. Now, whether twilight was a time that typically he could expect some rest, that God wouldn't send him visions at twilight and he could have some peace of mind, or maybe twilight was a time when he would get visions, but he didn't ever get any better visions. It was the same old horrible vision. You know, we don't really know what his point is there. But verse 5 indicates that the picture here is very much like in the book of Daniel with Belshazzar. The Persian army has surrounded the city of Babylon. The Babylon army is in shambles. The city's about to fall. What are they doing? They're partying. Well, that's kind of a bizarre attitude to have. So here in verse 5, they set the table, they spread out the cloth, they eat, they drink. You know, so they're having a party. They're doing all the things you do to have a party. But then, rise up, captains, oil the shields. Prepare for battle in the midst of all their partying. Well, that's a kind of a inopportune time, you know, to have to go out and fight and so on. And thus the Lord says to me, go station the lookout, let him report what he sees. And he sees this military procession that's going on. And the message comes that Babylon has fallen. And then verse 10, O my threshed people, my afflicted of the threshing floor, what I have heard from the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, I make known to you. And again, that's kind of ambiguous whether that's encouraging or discouraging. You know, do they find encouragement in this news, or will they be discouraged in that? Well, it's an open question, but I tend to think in this setting they're going to be discouraged that Babylon, in whom they could have put some confidence, and apparently, again, the whole purpose of the Babylonians sending that embassy of people to Hezekiah, and he showed them around his palace, wasn't just a tour, it was a political overture to make some kind of alliance against the Assyrians, and that's what why Isaiah was so upset about that, that Hezekiah was entertaining this alliance with the Babylonians. Well, if Babylon has fallen, you can forget looking to Babylon for any kind of support to help you with the Assyrians. And yet, on the other hand, in the future, this oracle would have a hope of encouragement to it, because once the Babylonians become this great world empire and oppressors of God's people, then that will bring a ring of hope to them that they will be freed from their Babylonian oppression. And incidentally, back up in verse 2, about the treacherous one, the destroyer, and so on, it's really interesting because what a lot of people think of war, you know, you might think of something like courage, self-sacrifice, you know, the noble attributes of war. That's not what Isaiah sees. Isaiah sees this treachery, this greed, this cruelty. That's what this warfare has meant to him. That these nations that have been out waging these campaigns and invading their neighbors and taking over and so on, is nothing courageous or noble or self-sacrificial about that. It's just greed and seeking to dominate others. And so that's his characterization of this militaristic attitude of a lot of these nations. And one final thing I might mention, verse 1, that is something of a paradox of its own, the wilderness of the sea, the desert of the sea. There's obviously some ways in which you can picture a desert like the sea. You know, it just spreads from horizon to horizon. There's nothing as far as the eye can see. But also, Babylon was called the Sea Land because it was on the southern, you know, part of Mesopotamian valley, and there along where the what we call the Persian Gulf today would be. And if Isaiah is calling it a desert, as if again, don't depend on it, don't turn to it for support, that'd be kind of an ironic statement that Sea Land has become a desert land. In terms of any kind of hope or power or military or political strength to deliver those of Judah. Well, I don't want to dwell on that too much. The upshot of it is Babylon has fallen. You see refugees streaming across the Arabian desert here. And the next couple of oracles depict that. Duma, in verse 11, is a city, an oasis in the northern Arabian Peninsula. In the Septuagint, the Greek translation, they understood Duma to be Edom. Not that there's a big difference between the two, because you're still dealing with peoples off to the southeast in the area of that Arabian desert that dominates the northern part of the Arabian Peninsula. But notice verses 11 and 12, the purpose of this oracle is, watchman, how far gone is the night? Watchman, how far gone is the night? The watchman says, morning comes, but also night. If you would inquire, come back again. You know, it's like one of these things, you're waiting for news, and it just seems interminable. Like, dawn's never going to get here. Night's never going to be over with. You know, are we there yet? You know, the kids in the back seat. That's the idea. And the answer is, can't tell. If you want to know, you're going to have to come back and ask again later. There's no answer. There's no response. And so the purpose of this oracle, the effect is, as the news of Babylon and the fall of Babylon and the spread of Assyrian power creeps its way across the Arabian desert, there's a kind of a tense expectation and unknown and mystery about what's going to happen. But that'll become obvious once the Assyrians are on the edge of Jerusalem. And then the same thing in verse 13 and following, oracle about Arabia. And so here again are some refugees from Babylon off the beaten path. You're going to have to spend the night in Arabia, the caravans of the Dedanites. The inhabitants of the land of Tema are told to bring water for these thirsty refugees that are coming through. Meet the fugitive with bread, for they fled from the swords, from the drawn sword, from the bent bow, and the press of battle. So again, you see these refugees coming through. And thus the Lord said to me, in a year, as a hired man would count it, all the splendor of Kedar will terminate. And the remainder of the number of bowmen, the mighty men of the sons of Kedar, will be few, for the Lord God of Israel has spoken. Well, again, that is to say that destruction of Babylon is going to spread, that the Assyrians aren't going to stop there. Here's this place, Kedar, which will also fall to the Assyrians. Their army and their glory and so on is going to be gone within a year. And he says, as a hired man counts a year. Now, what does that mean, do you think? Any of you have employees? And if they're supposed to work from 9 to 5, what do? They watch the clock very carefully, don't they? They know exactly what time it is. And they're supposed to get off at 5? They know exactly when it's 5, right? Well, that's what Isaiah means by this, that here's a man who's under obligation to put in his year, and he's not going to, you know, give you an extra couple days or anything like that. He knows exactly when a year is. And so it means in exactly a year, that's when these things are going to happen. So a relatively short time period. Shane?
Do they have any sort of different, like we have a work week, or there's so many business days in a year. We've got 365 total days in a year, but if you took business days, there's less than that.
Right.
So, I mean,
It could
be. Some reference?
Yeah, it could be an idiom used, but it is going to be a relatively short period of time. At least that that much is clear. So, all right. Well, now coming into chapter 22, the Valley of Vision. Now, if you just had to guess, what place would you think Isaiah would call a Valley of Vision? A valley where people are supposed to see clearly and know what's going on. Yeah, where God's people are, probably. So they're in Jerusalem, and I think that's right. And as we begin looking at this, we'll see that the references are to what's going on here in Jerusalem. So an oracle concerning the Valley Vision, and I think it's ironic, just like the other one was. The sea is a desert here. The Valley of Vision is the Valley of the Blind. God's people are just blind as bats. They don't see clearly. They don't really understand what's going on, because rather than looking to God that provides true vision, they're looking to, maybe the Egyptians will help us, or maybe the Babylonians will help us, or whatever, and they're just messed up. So, what is the matter with you now that you've all gone up to the rooftops? Probably running up to the rooftop to look out and see for news, again, to try to see what's going on is kind of the idea. Now, of course, literally, you can't see far looking from the rooftop, but, it's the idea of just trying to get information as quick as you can. Again, what's the word? What's the news of Babylon, perhaps, again, coming closer, or the news of the Assyrians drawing closer? You who were full of noise, you boisterous town, you exultant city, your slain were not slain with a sword, nor did they die in battle. all your rulers have fled together and have been captured without the bow. All of you who were found were taken captive together, though they had fled far away. And therefore, I say, turn your eyes away from me. Let me weep bitterly. Do not try to comfort me concerning the destruction of the daughter of my people. For the Lord of hosts has a day of panic, subjugation, and confusion in the Valley of Vision, a breaking down of walls and a crying to the mountain. And Elam took up the quiver with the chariots, infantry, and horsemen. Kir uncovered the shield. Then your choicest valleys were full of chariots, and the horsemen took up fixed positions at the gate, and he removed the defense of Judah. In that day you depended on the weapons of the house of the forest. You saw that the breaches and the wall of the city of David were many. You collected the waters of the lower pool. Then you counted the houses of Jerusalem. You tore down houses to fortify the wall. You made a reservoir between the two walls for the waters of the old pool, but you did not depend on him who made it, nor did you take into consideration him who planned it long ago. You can see the panic of the people in the city of Jerusalem as the Assyrian army approaches, getting closer and closer, and the rest of the nation is falling to the Assyrians, and they've busied themselves trying to secure their wall better and secure their water supply and all of this kind of thing, but they haven't put their trust in God. And so that oracle rounds out then verses 12 through 14. Therefore, in that day, the Lord God of hosts called you to weeping, to wailing, to shaving the head, to wearing sackcloth. Instead, there's gaiety and gladness, killing of cattle and slaughtering of sheep, eating of meat and drinking of wine. Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. But the Lord of hosts revealed himself to me. Surely this iniquity shall not be forgiven you until you die, says the Lord God of hosts. And so, it represents a kind of just complete despair here. I mean, if you were going to be facing a siege, the last thing you'd want to do is just wildly eat all your food and drink all your provisions and so on. You'd be rationing it out and trying to make it last as long as you could and do the best you could. But here it's just a complete... I guess ultimately what Isaiah is depicting here is these people are acting completely irresponsibly and the way you should act in the face of a particular situation. They're not using their common sense. They're not doing what one should do. And if you extended that principle, true common sense would have you look to God and take Him into account in your calculations. So I'm not suggesting that what Isaiah is saying is that you people don't know how to correctly address a siege here, that you ought to be fortifying the wall and securing your water supply and rationing out your provisions. His problem is more with their attitude, their heart, and the fact that it's not given to God. And in the face of this relentless assault of the Assyrians, the only possible hope is despair. I mean, there just is no hope. And so let's just party in the few minutes we've got left before we were killed by the Assyrians.
And along that same line, not only have they forgotten God, but it's like a total abandonment, and just going completely the opposite direction. Just, we're going to die tomorrow, so what difference does it make? Let's just do whatever we want to do.
Right. So, and again, the valley of vision. Yeah, that's great, great vision there, So, anyway. And what you're going to find then in verses 15 through 25 is kind of an illustration of that principle that we saw in the first 14 verses. And Isaiah will lay a lot of this problem of Jerusalem at the feet of the leadership. I mean, that's always an issue. I mean, people are responsible a great deal for the kind of leadership that they have, and they typically deserve the leadership they get. But that doesn't absolve the leaders themselves of all responsibility. And you do see in the history of Judah the difference that good kings periodically can make. And Hezekiah will eventually put his trust in the Lord and redeem the situation. But as we've seen, a lot of this happens under Hezekiah's oversight. And of course, Hezekiah is just not an absolute monarch that can just do anything he wants. He has to politically weigh all of the different factions in his court, and you're always going to have this pro-Egyptian group and this pro-Assyrian group and this pro-Babylonian group and so on, and his hands are going to be tied somewhat in just what he can do. But it was under his leadership that the walls of Jerusalem were built up and the water line was secured and so on. Which sounds like a good common sense provisions for preparing for the assault of the Assyrians. And again, I don't know that it's that Isaiah says you shouldn't have been fortifying your city or securing the water supply, but you've left God out of your calculations. That was the problem. You've not taken into consideration God. And what would God have you to do? That's the real issue. All right, well, in verses 15 and following, probably one of the most peculiar stories in the Bible, and yet almost unknown perhaps to many of us, but is the story of Shebna. And Shebna is the major domo or grand vizier of Hezekiah. And I used to think those were big words till I found out both of them were used in Disney movies. So, in The Lion King, that little bird guy is called the major domo of the king, the lion. And, of course, in Aladdin, Jafar is the grand vizier. Well, it's this the king's right-hand man, and he administers the kingdom on behalf of the king. And so he wields the authority of Hezekiah on Hezekiah's behalf. So the Lord tells Isaiah, come, go to this steward, to Shebna, who's in charge of the royal household, and say to him, what right do you have here? And whom do you have here that you have hewn a tomb for yourself here, you who hew a tomb on the height, you who carve a resting place for yourself in the rock? So, in other words, up on the cliffs on the east side of Jerusalem, overlooking the city of Jerusalem, where the burial tombs are, Shebna is more concerned about carving out a fancy tomb for him as a rich man. And that's the opportune moment that God sends Isaiah to him and says, what are you doing? You know, you ought to be doing your job and not up here, you know, worrying about, you know, where you're going to, how you're going to be buried and all this kind of stuff. You know, it's one of these things where people put more thought and effort into death than they do life. You know, you're worrying more about what you're going to be when you're dead rather than what you can do while you're alive. And Isaiah is basically going to tell Shebna that he's not going to live to be able to use his tomb, if that makes any sense, that he's going to die in some foreign land and so on. So, behold, the Lord is about to hurl you headlong, O man. He's about to grasp you firmly, roll you tightly like a ball, to be cast into a vast country. There you will die. There your splendid chariots will be, you shame of your master's house. I will depose you from your office. I will pull you down from your station. You're not doing your job, I'm going to throw you out. And he's going to be replaced by another guy named Eliakim. It'll come about in that day, I will summon my servant Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah. I will clothe him with your tunic, tie your sash securely about him. I will entrust him with your authority. He will become a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem, to the house of Judah. And I will set the key of the house of David on his shoulder. And when he opens, none will shut. What he shuts, none will open. I will drive him like a peg in a firm place, and he will become a throne of glory to his father's house. And so Shebna being booted out, and Eliakim is going to replace him, and he's going to be the guy who wields Hezekiah's authority on his behalf. Well, I asked you about where this comes back up in the New Testament. And did anyone find a New Testament connection? In the book of Revelation, okay. So what about it? What are we told? Okay, remember the church at Philadelphia? So Revelation chapter 3, verse 7. He who is holy, who is true, who has the key of David, who opens and no one will shut, who shuts and no one will open, says this, and I put before you an open door which no one can shut, and so on. Well, this is an allusion back to this passage in Isaiah. And, of course, what would the implication be then of its use there in Revelation? Who's the one that has the key of David and opens and shuts? Yeah, Jesus, apparently. So does that make Jesus somebody's major domo, right-hand man? God is the Father is the true king, and Jesus exercises his authority. Or it may be that obviously if the right-hand man has this kind of authority, the king does too. And so it could be that Jesus is the king who has this kind of authority as well as his right-hand man. But it also may appear in Matthew chapter 16 because you recognize some similarities that Jesus said Peter would be given the keys of the kingdom and what he would bind, none would loose, and what he would loose, none would bind. And also makes a play, of course, on Peter's name, being the rock. And on this rock I will build my church. Well, there's the same play on words being made here with Eliakim, because his name means God will place. And God will place, this person named God will place, in the place of Shebna, and he says, I will drive him like a peg in a firm place that you can depend upon. And so it's the imagery of a tent peg, which is the foundation of a tent building, I guess you could say. And so it may be that Jesus is making a play on words here and suggesting that the role of the apostles, not just Peter personally, like the Pope or something, but the role of the apostles is to administer the kingly authority on behalf of Jesus. And they do that, of course, by preaching the gospel. That's how the kingdom of God is going to spread. Well, we'll have to stop there and let everyone come in. And everything hanging on it like a peg in a wall is going to fall down. And again, I don't think that's to suggest Jesus is going to fail in the New Testament. But in the current situation, this peg is not going to be able to hold all the weight that they're going to put on it. But a better peg, Jesus, is going to come later on.